Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Now, Kieran, as you know, I don't normally read out birthday requests. I'm a Ginnam. But we've had one from a producer guy who wants to say happy birthday to Kieran Maguire, which is very sweet. Also saves him having to fork out for a first-class stamp. happy birthday, Kieran.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I am 60, which means I qualify for a senior citizens rail card, which when you're commuting from deepest Sussex to Liverpool is a positive.
Yeah. Does this mean you're going to stop laughing at schoolboy knob jokes now?
No, that would involve. Right. Yeah. I'm old, but I'm not grown up.
Welcome to my world. Later in the show, we will hear from Daniel Martin. He's Vice President of Finance and Corporate Development at Redbird FC, who currently own Toulouse Football Club and is looking to invest in more European clubs in the coming years. And it's a fascinating interview, I think you'll agree. But before that, some news stories. It's almost like a birthday present for you, Kieran, an old friend. Derby County's administrators missed Monday's EFL deadline to find a preferred bidder with proof of funds. The EFL issued rather a terse statement on Tuesday to that effect. I was going to say what happens now, but luckily we had to delay recording this pod until Wednesday afternoon because you were dandling grandchildren up and down. And between when we were supposed to do it and you being puked on by babies, there's been a statement from Derby's administrators which basically said, nothing to worry about, look away, all's fine.
Yes, and there's been a subsequent second publication or statement from the EFL to say, well, that's not saying very much. Yeah. I think it's a bit like when the Baroness has asked me to paint a door or to fix something in the house, and of course I've prevaricated and found excuses, and now you get that patient stare, and this is what we're getting from the EFL, and the EFL have, you know, that they've allowed the administrators to try to do their job, to try to get on with things, to support as best that they can, and now they're reaching the period of just being completely fed up. And the most recent statement from the EFL have said, we've had no communication from Quantuma, the administrators. Yeah. They're not replying to calls, they're not replying to emails, they're not replying to anything as far as the EFL lawyers are concerned. And I know in one of the previous statements from the administrators, they said that their non-communication was strategic. Mm. Now, that to me is pretty appalling. I used to work in the insolvency industry, and you are dealing with a large number of stakeholders. There are, first of all, the employees. They're entitled to know what's on. I have connection with some of the staff at Derby County. I think it's fair to say they've not got a clue what's going on. And certainly, you know, when I used to do this job, I used to make an effort every week to have a meeting either with the trade union reps or to call a meeting with as many staff as possible to say, look, there's not a lot I can say. This is what we're trying to do. This is the progress we met at the meet. Communication is essential because communication can help to allay people's fears. So there's people who are of course at Derby County who are now walking away. They're finding themselves. You know, we're talking about back office staff. They're starting to find other jobs, which is perfectly right and proper with all the uncertainty involved, which means that there's gaps appears, in terms of some of the functions at the club, which doesn't help things. You know, Wayne Rooney is doing a fantastic job, but you need both front office, back office, and on the pitch all to be working efficiently for that to take place. In terms of the other issues that the Quantuma have previously said have been challenges, well, you know, they made a big case in respect of, well, it's all Middlesbrough's fault. Well, yeah. You know, we spoke a few weeks ago. Mel Morris and Steve Gibson have reached and I quote an accord to put that particular problem to bed. So Why haven't we made progress? Where are the proof of funds for the remainder of the season? We know that some players were sold in the January window. If they were sold, and that's going to see Derby County through to the end of the season, then it should not be difficult for the administrators to simply put together a spreadsheet to show how the money's come from, to say these are our committed costs for the rest of the season, and send that to the EFL. Why are they not doing this? To me, it's a lack of professionalism, which really bugs me. And as I've said to you before, I know some other people in the insolvency industry, and I said, yeah, why has it gone to this firm? And they said, well, yeah, lots of reputable firms took a look at Derby, and what they were inheriting, which was a series of companies which had been put into administration, but not the company that owns the stadium. So your biggest asset that you're potentially selling, which is your property asset, isn't included, which makes things more difficult. But this firm, they were appointed by Mel Morris. And if you take a look at what Quantumware have said in all of their pronouncements, they've complained about COVID, they've complained about the EFL, they've complained about Wycombe Wanderers, they've complained about Middlesbrough Football Club. The one person who they've not said a single negative thing about is Mel Morris. Draw your own conclusions.
I have to say, Kieran, as an outsider, the tone of the administrator's press release this afternoon, Wednesday afternoon, was almost petulant. It was basically saying, we've got loads of bidders, loads of them. We're just deciding which one we prefer, and as soon as we know, we'll let you know. That could be next week, it could be next month. But
They said similar before Christmas.
They did, indeed. And also, looking at the website of Derby newspaper, they're reporting that the administrators have told them they have a meeting with the EFL on Monday, but that seems to be news to the EFL.
Well, the EFL have put something out today. So, I'm underwhelmed.
Yeah.
I'm doing my best to hide it.
Yeah. Well, I know it's a strange, but you've got professional pride, Kieran. It's you know, I've seen my club go through two administrations, and the companies doing that didn't behave like this. Global news: Everton investor Alisher Usmanov has had his assets frozen due to his close ties with Vladimir Putin. Is this anything for Everton fans to worry about?
We will have to wait and see. And again, since we were originally supposed to record, and we have actually recorded, Everton have now put out a subsequent press release to say that they have severed ties with all of Alisher Usmanov's companies, which are USM Holdings, who have the naming rights for Finch Farm, which is Everton's training facilities, Megafon, who are the sponsors of the women's team, and another one of his companies as well. They are also quite clearly offering as much support and care as they can for their Ukrainian player. It's very disturbing. I'm not playing violins here. My son plays a big computer game, which is one of these global things, and he's in a European group, and he's got friends who are from Belarusia, from Russia, from Ukraine. And they're all friends. They're just young people together. Yeah. And some of the Russian kids, and we're talking young people kids, here. Yeah. They've ended up as conscripts in the Russian army, and he was in communication with them a few days ago, and he says, "Do you think you're going to invade?" And they just turned back into him and said, and they started laughing. They said, "There's no way we can invade. We've not got uniform that fits. We've got we've been given rifles which are from the Cold War era. They're old school rifle. Yeah, they're useless." We've got no food. We're having to scavenge for food. And this was when they were on the border. This was before the invasion took place. And these young people didn't think this was going to take place. Subsequently, I was talking, and he's quite distressed. You know, two of his friends who are 20 years of age, who were sent in first, because you send in the kids first if you're a fucking maniac like Putin. Yeah. Two of his friends have been killed. Jesus. 20 years of age. They are somebody's son, somebody's boyfriend, somebody's. Well, how do you explain? You know, this is my generation. Yeah, these are people of my generation, like Putin. who are grown-ups in theories, you know, people who are capable of making smart decisions. Why is he doing this to the sons and Russia, as well, of course, as the people in Ukraine who are being slaughtered by his cronies? I don't do things like this, but I'm angry.
I know. I could tell, Kim, we're all angry, and this is not the pod to discuss it, but I feel very, we were talking in the pub last night, the grandsons and sons of my generation, the people who are in their teens and early 20s, were of course terrified and anxious. So the difference is that our generation grew up with it as a sort of background noise. Russia was always there as a background noise. So this wouldn't have come as any surprise to most of the older people, but to younger people who have grown up with largely knowing nothing but peace, it is terrifying. But the idea of Everton, quite rightly, I think, severing links with Alisher Usmanov, will that be temporary? Is that the sort of thing that once there is, please God, some kind of peace in Ukraine, some kind of deal, and life moves on, will they then be quietly saying, well, you've got your money back now, Alisher, we'd quite like to have some of it? Or is that the end of his tenure investing in Everton?
I think we will have to wait and see. There have been historic, very close links between Alisher Usmanov and the Everton owner, Farhad Moshiri. They were business partners. Farhad Moshiri invested in Arsenal when he then sold his shares to Alisher Usmanov, and he used the proceeds of his share sale to buy his investment in Arsenal. Alisher Usmanov tried to take over Arsenal. He was rebuffed by Stan Kroenke. He therefore threw his toys out of the pram and says, right, I'm selling all of my investment to Stan Kroenke. And since then, he has had a closer relationship, again, with Farhad Moshiri. He has spoken about what might happen with regards to the stadium and the naming rights and so on. So clearly there is a longer-term relationship than perhaps we see in many sort of standard sponsorship arrangements between the two individuals. But we don't know how long this conflict's going to continue.
Let's have a Chelsea update as well, Kieran. I've heard from several sources that the trustees of the Chelsea Foundation are totally bemused and baffled by being handed stewardship of the club by Roman Abramovich. Stewardship, a word that has no legal meaning, as far as anybody could see. But there are strong rumours as well, Kieran, that the club's been offered to at least one Swiss billionaire who may or may not be very rich due to doing a pod called Swiss Ramble. I don't know. But it seems like Abramovich is still frightened that his assets may be seized, despite the fact he's an Israeli citizen, and he wants to offload the club so the club don't suffer from that.
Well, yes, I mean, this report has broken today, Wednesday. It's an 86-year-old Swiss billionaire who he's claiming, and we don't know how accurate this claim is, that he and other ultra-high net worth individuals have been offered the opportunity to buy Chelsea Football Club. Chelsea would be an attractive investment because it's in a desirable part of London. It's the current UEFA Champions League holders. It's the current FIFA World Club Cup holders. It's won the Premier League. So you know, there are some positives. Against that, you've got people such as Jim Ratcliffe, head of Ineos. He's British. He's Britain's richest man, if reports are to be believed. And you know, you never quite know how wealthy people are, but he's wealthier than producer guy. So yeah, he's
up there.
If he's not the richest, he's certainly in the top one. So he I think quite tellingly said a couple of years ago that Chelsea was offered to him, or Chelsea was certainly, you know, it was made known that Chelsea was potentially available. But he felt the price being asked was too high, around about £2 billion. And then there's the ongoing issue with Stamford Bridge. It's not big enough. Is the simple statement there. Old Trafford holds, I think it's now 74,000. The Glazers are potentially going to increase that to 80. Liverpool are at 54. They want to expand to 60. Manchester City are looking to expand to 60. We've got West Ham, Arsenal and Spurs in London at 60 plus. So, you know, that's going to be an expensive project. And also, it's going to take a long time to sort, because finding a property space in London with the appropriate planning permission to build a 60,000 plus stadium is not going to be an easy task. And it's going to involve perhaps dismantling existing properties, getting the right planning permission, and then there's the issue of funding. So Chelsea has many positives, but also I think from an investor's point of view, it has challenges as well.
Yeah, Chelsea have some very rich neighbours in Stamford Bridge. They don't like it when someone wants a swimming pool in a basement. They're not going to like Chelsea trying to buy their house to knock it down for a corporate hospitality. ITV, Kieran, are going to show EFL highlights from next season. Is this a new broadcasting deal or part of an existing one?
No. This is taking over the existing deal that ITV have with, I think it's Quest, which is satellite channel. Presented by Colin Murray, who I've got to know Colin quite well. He's not invited me on Fighting Talk yet, which I'm still. I go on his show. I go on his show at 11:30 night, and sort of speak for ages. But okay, any chance of Fighting Talk? Colin said, "No, you're not funny."
Well, if it's any consolation, Kieran, he has invited me back, and I'm in the business. Essentially,
right.
Last time I spoke to him, he said, "Why don't we do it in Manchester now?" So it's a long way. It's like, it's not how it works anymore, Colin.
this is internet thingy.
Yeah, although it's quite hard to get a word in edgeways when you're talking to Colin Murray in any circumstance. He's very entertaining, very chatty.
He's fantastically entertaining, and possibly the sweariest man I've ever met, which is quite challenging, having grown up in the dressing room of my cricket club. So there's a hell of an achievement.
You've not worked with Johnny Vaughan then?
Right. this is going to be a new EFL highlights deal. I think it's going to be on ITV3 or 4.
ITV4.
ITV4. And I think from the EFL's perspective, from what I gather, it's not necessarily going to be significantly more lucrative, if at all, but ITV4 will get the benefits of being, there'll be adverts for it on sort of the main ITV channels. So they're hoping to double the number of viewers. And that's good for the profile of the EFL, and you wish them all the best. And there's some cracking football that takes place in the Championship and League One and League Two.
Yeah, I have to say as well, Kieran, ITV don't have a lot of sport, but what they do have, they show very well. I mean, certainly their FA Cup programmes and their rugby programmes are very good. Their horse racing coverage is really good and has really helped build the profile of horse racing. So hopefully that's something that can happen for the EFL, because it's a shame that the highlights were tucked away on Quest. Potential good news, Kieran, for fans worried that the owner of their club may want to move it to a new ground or sell the stadium or change the badge and playing colours.
Yes, this is something which is coming from the Football Association. And yes, it's absolutely to be welcomed. By a pure coincidence, it was also one of the recommendations of Tracy Crouch's fan-led review report. And this would be some of the issues that would have to been approved by the shadow board or by the fans consortium that was the official sort of liaising with the club. And first of all, I do welcome it. Secondly, the cynic in me feels that what the Football Association and the Premier League are trying to do is to offer a few of the recommendations, a few of the crumbs from the table of the Crouch report themselves. And therefore, they'll be able to turn around and say, well, look, we're giving you some of the stuff that you want. So therefore, we don't need an independent regulator. We don't need increased financial scrutiny. We don't need increased transparency. So they are, this is part of a much bigger scheme, and I think it's you know, coordinated. It's noticeable the people that are being put forward from the Premier League to say, well, we're jolly good fellows, but we're not overly happy with the report. None of the big six have opened their mouths with regards to this because their reputations are tainted by Super League and by Project Big Picture. So it's. I think it's going to be a challenge. It's going to make things more difficult for those people who are working to come up with legislation in respect of potentially getting something into a Queen's Speech. And you know, clearly, we've spoken to Tracy on a couple of occasions. Yeah, with it, and if it doesn't go into the Queen's Speech this year, then it gets kicked into the long grass again. And we've seen recommendations sort of. You know, then effectively just go into abeyance, which I don't think is in the best interests of the governance of the game that we love. Now, you know, the game that the owners and the executives love is a different one to ours.
Yeah, it's a good job that neither of us are of a cynical frame of mind, Kieran, because, you know, despite the fact this pod could make us both so, but if we were of a cynical frame of mind, either of us could suggest that this is quite an easy one for the FA to offer up, isn't it? Basically, there's no financial backlash for this one. It's just the FA saying, right, well, okay, what we're going to do, if you want to change your club's kit, you've got to ask our permission. We're not necessarily saying you won't get it, but you've got to ask it first. So it is quite a simple one that makes them look good in fans' eyes, but is very easy for them to do. Now, Kieran, Woking is a town that's very dear to both our hearts because it's home, of course, of one of the world's greatest bands, The Jam. It's also home to Woking FC, who made a small profit in 2020-21, but big losses overall. How did that happen?
Woking has lost a few million historically, and say that they just more than broke even as far as 2021 was concerned. What we've seen over the course of the last 3 or 4 days is there's been about a dozen to 15 clubs in England and Scotland who have published results, which has even by my standards of loving a spreadsheet has put me into overdrive. But I think it's indicative of we were fearing Armageddon, especially in the lower leagues and non-league football as a result of COVID. But through a combination of grants, fan support, owner support, clubs have managed to cling on with their fingernails, and that's where we are at present. So, I would sort of say the non-league clubs, unless they're trying to buy themselves promotion, have done just about okay. If we take a look at the Premier League, Arsenal have published their results. Arsenal's losses are substantial, but Stan Kroenke seems to think he's going to underwrite those losses. I think it's interesting, well, from my point of view, that Arsenal appear to have got rid of their external loans, and instead they're borrowing them in-house from Stan Kroenke. Liverpool's losses are down. We're seeing some of the clubs in the Championship report as well. They're not great financial results in England. And then you contrast that to Scotland, where practically every club that I've seen in the lower leagues is saying, yeah, we've broken even or we've made a small profit. And that is very much on the back of furlough. And I think there's a guy called James Anderson who's been an incredibly benevolent supporter of Scottish football. And he's given the Scottish Football Authorities some cash to distribute across the whole of the Scottish League. So Scotland's come out of this relatively well. Lower leagues, just about okay, I think, in terms of survival due to the Premier League grants and loans, to the use of furlough and so on, and also the EFL loans. Barnsley reported their results. They've taken some of the EFL loans as well. And again, we've spoken to people connected to the Championship, and going back to our first story in Derby, one of the things which bugs other owners and other chief executives is they borrowed money, which therefore has to be repaid. Mel Morris didn't borrow any money from the EFL. He ran up huge debts to HMRC, and then put the club into administration. And there's a groundswell of anger towards him. But not yet. And that you have to separate the owner from the club here. If Derby fans think that other club owners have got it in for them, I don't think that is the case. But there is a lot of bad blood directed towards the owner.
Yeah. I don't know if I should tell you this, Kieran, but producer Guy and I, we just couldn't think of a birthday present for you. So what we did, we phoned up 15 or 20 clubs and just said, would you mind releasing your financial results on Kieran's birthday? Honestly, it would cheer me. I'm really pleased that so many of them made the effort. One of those clubs, Kieran, we'll talk about Manchester United in a moment, but one of those clubs who reported their figures was Reading. And if Woking made a small profit, Reading made a whopping loss.
Yeah, £35 million in the Championship is pretty grim. On the basis of that, they would have submitted figures to the EFL earlier than the ones that are formally published. And of course, Reading have now have suffered a points deduction on the back of that and are working towards a budget. They've been told that they've got to get their wage bill down substantially. My understanding from boots on the ground, shall we say, are that they are keeping as best they can to those wage targets, and they have a suspended sentence in terms of a points deduction. But if everything goes to plan, the players they released last year and the players they're planning to release this year should reduce their wage bill substantially enough to mean that they're not going to have the remainder of the points deduction applied. But it means that, are you going to be as competitive as you want to be? No, you're not. And this is the challenge within Championship football. Yeah. It's a mess from a financial perspective.
Still on the theme of loss, unfortunately, Coventry City's parent company, Sky Blues Sport and Leisure, made a loss of about £5 million last season.
Yes, that's actually, in my view, a pretty decent result. And that's how crazy things are. You know, I'm saying that a football club's lost £5 million and has done well. But Coventry do have pretty decent cost control. Clearly, they've had the ongoing challenges in terms of where they're going to play their home fixtures. That now appears to be resolved. So I think Coventry are moving forwards, and fair play to them to that. Trying to work out the motives of the club's owners has been has confused practically everybody involved, because they are a hedge fund. You know, normally any financial institution is purely looking to make money from buying and selling assets, but they've stuck with Coventry for some time, and Cov are having a good season. And I think it would be I've got no preferences for clubs, but I think it would be fantastic if they were rewarded by getting back to the Premier League on the back of that.
Well, partly because, as we said before, it's a very decent away day.
Yes, there's always that to bear in mind.
Nottingham Forest have issued over a billion new shares. And even with my limited grasp of mathematics, Kieran, that's a lot of shares, isn't it? A billion.
That's a lot of shares. They're going, blimey O'Reilly, I thought. And they've now got over 7 billion shares, which is astounding. We're talking about a small football club. And then you find out that they've been issued for a penny each.
Oh, okay.
So whilst it was they issued over a billion, in terms of the actual total value, it worked out as £12 million. And it's not fresh cash for the club. But instead of that, what's happened is that the owners have converted £12 million worth of loans into shares.
Ah, okay.
But that still, to me, is a positive, because whatever happens as far as the future of the club is concerned, that £12 million does not have to be repaid to the owners. You know, the nature of shares is that they have an infinite life, and there is never any obligation to repay them.
Yeah. This next present, Kieran, was so big that producer Guy and I thought we might make it birthday and Christmas. but Manchester United's latest accounts are out.
Yes, Manchester United have published their second quarterly reports. This is to cover the first 6 months of the year from a financial perspective. So this covers the period to the 31st of December 2021. And the good news from United's perspective is that match day money is up with the return of crowds. Manchester United have normally had the highest gate receipts of any club in the country, although I think that is now being challenged by Spurs, because while Spurs have a slightly lower capacity than Manchester United, their price per fan in terms of what they can extract in terms of ticket prices is considerably higher, mainly because they've got a stadium where if you do go and stand or sit there, you're not going to get rained on. So I think that Manchester United are going to find it hard to keep that particular crown in their cabinet. But their wage bill is shooting up, and that's going to be on the back of signing Varane, signing Sancho, signing Cristiano Ronaldo. But the one thing that stuck out for me from the report was it says a £10 million payoff to former members of staff. So, there's a lot of affection towards Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in Manchester, and rightly so for all that he achieved, especially as a player. And he will always be welcome there because people will associate him with the treble in 1999 and beating Bayern Munich. But he left not only with their good wishes, but he won't be needing to sell the big issue for a month or two. Except, of course, if fuel prices keep rising, then how long 10 million is going to go, I'm not too sure.
My good friend Ash is an Ethiopian Man United fan. He runs the off-license down the road, so as you can imagine, he and I are very close. He's obsessed with football, but in the unlikely event, Kieran, that you're ever popping into the off-license just down the road from me, and Ash is there, don't mention Cristiano Ronaldo, because he's just can't. Everything that's wrong at Man United, he thinks, is down to Cristiano Ronaldo. He's not a fan, let's put it this way. Two more stories before that. Really interesting interview you did with Daniel. Private equity groups are lining up a deal worth more than £1 billion. £1 billion. Again, we use the word billion. £1 billion to get a share of France's Ligue 1 broadcast income.
You sound naturally French there.
Yeah, I'm a bit bummed up at the moment. That's why that helps. as a result of getting rained on continually for an hour and a half on the way to Palais yesterday and an hour and a half back. I say an hour and a half. We stopped at several pubs. Why we stayed outside the pub, I don't know. But it's what a shocking game that was. So Ligue 1 broadcast income, £1 billion is a lot of money to pay to get a share of that, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's indicative of the attractiveness of the bigger leagues that private equity is willing to come in, and what they will effectively do is that they will give the French football authorities money up front, which will help. I think it's fair to say that French football has been hit to a greater extent than football here in England, because there's certain aspects of the lockdown were more severe, and they don't have the benefit of such large broadcast deals. So what will happen is that the private equity groups will give them an amount up front, and then they'll be taking, I think it's around about 15% of French football income going forwards for quite a few years. So when you actually add up the numbers, they'll be getting considerably more than £1 billion back. Yeah. But what they will claim, and this is what private equity companies always do, is say, we have the expertise to negotiate and identify better broadcasting deals going ahead in the future. So, yes, we might be taking our 15%, but it's going to be 15% of a much bigger figure than you've historically had. Whether that is achievable or not, I'm not so sure. French football is the poor relation of the big five in Europe, partly due to it being dominated by one club. And if you have a dynasty, if you have a monopoly in terms of the way that trophies are distributed, from a broadcaster's perspective, that takes away jeopardy, that takes away risk. And jeopardy and risk is one of the reasons why we do watch football. One of the benefits we have here in the Premier League is, yes, we know that Manchester City have been fantastically successful recently, but they're not guaranteed to win the Premier League. You know, it's still not a one horse race this season, and that's great because you're watching matches because if they drop a couple of points here, does this mean Liverpool back into it? You know, there's still the big fight in terms of fourth place as well, and that generates eyeballs. Eyeballs generate income.
Yeah, I must admit, we didn't expect quite as much jeopardy and risk as we got last night in a home FA Cup game against a team halfway down the Championship. But yeah, you know, maybe somebody told Patrick Vieira that's the reason we go. They love the jeopardy and the risk. Yeah, give them some jeopardy and the risk. This last story, Kieran, apologies to any real French people out there listening.
you've caught the French bug now.
This last story is a real hold the front page story, and in the mood you're in, I'm quite looking forward to hearing your response. FIFA and the football federations in North, Central, and South America are going to receive $32 million in relation to being victims of fraud and corruption within football. That's a plot twist, isn't it? FIFA being the victims of corruption. From whom are they going to receive this money?
Well, this is on the back of a Department of Justice investigation in the United States, and it's all to do with the way that TV rights were sold and negotiated by certain parties, and it looks as if on the back of this, the US authorities believe in total over $200 million worth of money was set aside in the word that they use, which I love, racketeering.
Nice.
Which is something we don't use enough in the UK. And I've got family who are upset. They'd be quite happy to be using words like that. All of the money's been recovered.
The ones
course,
that like because, tennis, of course.
Yes, Wimbledon fans.
Yeah, of course. but
not all the money has been recovered because that's the nature of proceeds of crime. It gets squirreled away in various places. But as the countries associated with the federations which cover North, Central, and South America have been the biggest losers in this, they are going to get some of the money back, which is good. I mean, because ultimately it has been denied to the confederations and therefore the individual nations. And many of the individual countries within those geographical areas do fantastic work with money from FIFA. Not all. I think the audit trail could perhaps be better. There is simply too much corruption that we see in football because, as we know, it attracts wrong ones.
Yeah. Must be slightly confusing for Infantino, the boss of FIFA. He's used to getting backhanders, obviously, but he must be wondering why the American legal system are giving him money. He's obviously wondering how he's going to get them in the World Cup now. Got another team to get in the World Cup. Now, Daniel Martin is Vice President of Finance and Corporate Development at Redbird FC, which currently owns Toulouse Football Club and is looking to invest in more European clubs and, of course, a part of the Redbird Group, which has an interest in Liverpool. That all sounds a bit grown up. So Kieran interviewed Daniel on his own. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by Pact Coffee. Big coffee is bad coffee, full of underpaid farmers and low-quality over-roasted beans, all of which just leaves a bad taste in the mouth. Pact is changing the coffee industry from the grounds up.
From paying a price that's more than fair to knowing farmers on a first-name basis, Pact builds long-term relationships that flourish, putting the needs of their partners first and providing coffee that's personal to their customers. With Pact, you'll get award-winning specialty coffee, freshly roasted to perfection for your order, and ground just moments before it's shipped. There's over 15 different coffees on the menu at any given time to choose from, including Great Taste 2020 and 2021 winners.
So, make a pact to make better coffee now. Price of Football listeners get a free V60 and filter kit when they first sign up to a Pact plan. Just go to pactcoffee.com. That's PACTcoffee.com. And enter the code POF at the checkout to create your flexible coffee subscription and get that free brewing kit. Make a pact to make better coffee. Better for the farmer, better for the consumer, better for the planet.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Daniel, thank you so much for coming on the show. If I can just sort of go through sort of things on a chronological basis in terms of your involvement with football. You were originally at Deloitte. Were you in the football element of Deloitte, or were you just, you know, concentrating on the main part of the business there?
Well, firstly, thanks, Kieran. It's a real pleasure to be on the show. You know, I'm a real avid listener of the show. On Deloitte, I was working at that point in the corporate finance division. So getting involved in M&A activity, transaction services. I'd previously completed my 3 years audit training, chartered accountancy training. And it was actually through a contact at Deloitte, the head partner in the division. He knew the CFO well at Celtic, and at that point they'd reached out asking to find an individual who'd like to be a business accountant at Celtic.
Right. And was it a baptism of fire? Because football is an industry that never seems to stop, and I would imagine in a city such as Glasgow, you are under a degree of scrutiny. And I've heard somebody says, you know, half the city hates you and half the city thinks that they own you. What was it a really intense environment in which to work? Because, you know, looking at the period in which you were involved, you started there in 2009. Celtic were in the Champions League, you beat Barcelona. We had the issues with Setanta. There were issues taking place with Rangers. It must have been just an incredible working environment.
Well, yeah. So a number of great points you touched on there. Was it a baptism of fire? That's a good description. You're coming from what's a professional service background. Most people within sort of big four firms are kind of aligned in the way their methodology of working is, but you go into a football environment, and what struck me originally was, you know, the contrast in different departments within the auspices of a football club. So, you know, you've got everything from obviously the playing side, but you've got a commercial division, you've got a security business, a multimedia business, and a whole range of individuals and backgrounds within that. So that was fascinating as my first step into industry. Going back to Celtic in that period, you're right. I think the first few months, I think the Setanta deal, media rights deal had collapsed. So that was a bit of baptism of fire. But the highs of nights like Barcelona winning 2-1 on our 125th anniversary, those moments will stay with me for a long time. I am a Celtic fan, full transparency. But with that brings additional pressure. And I think you've alluded to it. I think the best way to describe it is, you know, the highs on the pitch, you feel them more, but the lows, you feel them a bit lower as well when you're maybe working on the inside.
Right, right. So you were there for 5 years, and you saw a lot of changes. Is there additional pressures in Glasgow itself, because being second is being nowhere as far as the Premiership is concerned, and therefore you must be under intense pressure to deliver to the fan base, who will always have very high expectations.
Yeah, I mean, similar to a lot of cities in the UK. You know, you think of Manchester and Liverpool, but Glasgow is an intense goldfish bowl to some extent, and that brings added pressure. But I think if we focus on Celtic strategy at the time and still to the current day, you know, the break-even methodology that was put in place a number of years ago. We all know Scottish football has a constraint on resources with TV rights. That's well known, as you pointed out before. I think at that point, £3 million to win the league. So the real game changer for Celtic and Rangers is that European participation. And, you know, Champions League level at that point, you know, you could add up to £30 million to your bottom line just by accessing group stages. But having that discipline, or the boards having that discipline to stick within that framework, even though the pressures that we've talked about for increased spend on players or additional capex elsewhere, it's having that discipline. That was one of the interesting things for me. It was learning at an early point in my sort of football business career that sort of governance model. And you can see it's still quite rare to this day, given what we see across Europe. But so I was very fortunate to enter football, you know, in that environment.
Yeah, and you touched on, you know, Celtic also being a listed company. But does that bring extra pressures? Because if you take a look at many of the clubs which have private ownership, the viewpoint of fans is that the purpose of a board of directors is every year, or in fact every 6 months, to write out a blank check to invest in players. Now, surely being a listed company, the responsibilities are to the shareholders first and foremost, and that gives you an extra layer that you have to deal with.
Yeah, again, you're spot on, Kieran. So Celtic was AIM listed. It had originally been main market FTSE listed. And the chairman at the time, Brian Quinn, who was ex-governor of Bank of England, he gave an undertaking that the reporting requirements would still meet FTSE standard, even though AIM listed. So again, just having that background of governance and trying to adopt PLC type methodologies, but you're right, that's sometimes in conflict with what maybe the fan base would want. So always striking that balance between, you know, resource allocation versus sporting aspirations. That was always something that was at the forefront of certainly the board's mind and Celtic strategy when I was there.
Yeah, and Celtic have managed to deliver on the pitch whilst at the same time having a break-even model. As you know, I'm obsessed with football club accounts, and I've got everything going back, you know, to the last century. And the model appears to be get your income to match your costs and then sell one player a year. Were you sort of budgeting who that player was going to be, perhaps 12 to 18 months in advance, to say, well, this is what we think we can do, and then we can use the proceeds of that sale to reinvest into players? Yeah, was it sort of that granular, or was it more ad hoc that you'd say, well, we have to sell one player every summer, and you see what came along in terms of bidding clubs?
So talking at the budgeting process, so we wouldn't budget for the football success of Champions League, given at that point there wasn't direct entry in. So we're always budgeting from a revenue side for group stage Europa League participation. So if you start with that that sort of revenue base and work down through the cost base, you know, the balancing figure, we would have a notional amount for a player gain or a gain on sale, not necessarily identified. I think conscious things evolve within the market, and having that flexibility to manoeuvre. But having that strong balance sheet built up over time gave that flexibility. To share an anecdote, the other side of it that's maybe often missed is just how well some of the player trading was over that period. And I would say it was Moneyball without the data analytics. If I reference, Virgil van Dijk at that point, bought from a nominal sum from Groningen, and then ultimately to where he's gone to today. That was just one of many examples. Wanyama, Kiso Young, Gary Hooper. So giving them that platform of Champions League, developing that asset value and knowing the right time to kind of liquidate and try and build again for the next season.
Yeah, because I remember in respect of Virgil van Dijk, I know we at Brighton, we were in the Championship at the time, and we'd identified him and were trying to persuade him to come. And we had Barnsley on a Tuesday night and you had Barcelona. And for some reason, Daniel, he chose to go to Scotland. And I still don't understand it myself.
Well, listen, from a Scottish perspective, there's not many pluses from giving them economic terms to attract players. But certainly, for the top two clubs, having that European platform can certainly sway certain players if they have a longer term career path in mind.
So you had, 5 years at Celtic, then you went to Etihad Airways, and then you went back into football. This was was it Al Jazeera in Abu Dhabi? So I presume that's linked to Sheikh Mansour and the City Football Group?
Yeah, that's correct. So I took the position of CFO and COO at Al Jazeera Club, owned by Sheikh Mansour. Not formally part of the CFG network, But that said, shared ownership through Sheikh Mansour as being his local club in Abu Dhabi. And really that role was part of a transformation project with a couple of guys from CFG who were executives who went in as CEO and CCO. And continuing that theme of my career and a bit of a passion, it was about trying to bring some sustainability and financially sustainable models to a league or to a club, but generally at macro level to a league that probably wasn't familiar with those concepts. So very interesting journey over about an 18-month period to try and bring that path to sustainability.
And where would you benchmark football in Abu Dhabi and the Middle East compared to where we are in Europe, in terms of leagues? What would you say would be sort of the closest benchmarks?
I think we're looking at maybe second tier leagues, second or third tier leagues in the big five countries, yeah. Perhaps. What I would say is, if you look at the UAE, Saudi, I've done a bit of work there as well on the football front, Qatar, there is a real appetite to develop the football, certainly grassroots level and national level, but also develop the leagues, the main leagues. And again, going back years, it seemed to be an outpost for aging stars to come and earn unlimited wages. But the mindset's changed now and actually, if I focus back on that project at Al Jazeera, we did some good things there, bringing in a sporting director, a great guy, Mads Davidson, who'd worked in China and really lowered the average age of the squad, looked at the wage bill, making it, sustainable within that budgeting model we talked about before, similar to what Celtic were doing. The interesting thing is just the growth that's still to come, I think, in these leagues as the years are developed. We obviously know the World Cup's going to be in the region soon, and it'll be interesting to see how again it moves on from that.
Great. So you've dealt with sort of the nuts and bolts of football. You've been at the coalface, and then you stepped away and you joined Redbird. Was that your choice? Did they headhunt you, or was it just the right time, right place?
Yeah, there was a bit of that. So the backstory was that the Al Jazeera was a specific remit, and that came kind of, we were in a good position to kind of hand over to the next layer of management. At that point, I was headhunted. I was approached through Nolan Partners, who are a sports recruiter, and they introduced me to the guys at Redbird Capital Partners, and at that point of the discussion, they were embarking on an acquisition in France, which is Toulouse FC, and had a wider thesis of investment in European football. So Paul thought it'd be interesting if I spoke to the guys, and then a few months later, I took my current position.
Right, right. So I mean, you've mentioned Celtic using Moneyball light, for want of a better phrase. Mm. Do you use a similar analytics approach as far as determining your investments, and once you've got investments, how does Redbird get involved on the operational side of things in terms of player recruitment and talent spotting?
Mm. Yeah, so I am VP of finance and corporate development at Redbird FC, and Redbird FC is a sports or international sports and data analytics platform. So it's really where Redbird Capital Partners, which is the PE firm based in US, it's where they deploy the capital, and we do it in partnership with some top analytic focused executives in sports, so Billy Bean and Luke Bourne. Now under Redbird FC platform as well as Toulouse, we have an investment in data analytics platform called Zealous, which is really powering a lot of how we make decisions, mostly on the playing side, because ultimately how we would view it as value on the pitch and off the pitch is ultimately driven by those playing decisions. So if we take back to the Celtic discussion, a lot of that was maybe scouting, agent led, but certainly looking for hidden talent and developing and moving on. Now with Zealous, things have evolved to certainly a more of a scientific nature, and data analytics, as we know, is a growing theme. And a lot of it's above my head, I will be honest. I am but a layman accountant, but some of the outputs I've seen from the Zealous system and how that translates into lose results has been fascinating for me.
And ultimately, you'd say the aim is to punch above your weight in terms of you've got a rough idea of what expectation of revenues, and then in terms of player recruitment, you then can benefit on the back of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So identifying talent that you think is that's undervalued, that you could then acquire and obviously develop and ultimately sell on. So that's a big part of it, is really trying to compete with others with lower resources and a lower wage bill, but actually compete at the same level.
Right. Yep. So you've got, was it 85% of Toulouse?
Yes.
You've got a stake in FSG, which famously owns Liverpool FC. And I, when I do my analysis, again, I'm an accountant. I'm a dweeb, but I know nothing about football in terms of the technical side of things. But I see, as far as that's concerned, that Liverpool has spent, since Sir Alex Ferguson retired, they've spent £500 million less than Chelsea, Manchester United and Manchester City, and yet they seem to be outperforming. And do you think that therefore gives them an edge? Because it must be very difficult to compete when you are ultimately an investment operation against organisations whose KPIs are not financial. If they are trophy assets, if the ambitions of the owners are nothing to do with getting a financial return, and therefore they've effectively got a blank check, it must be a huge challenge.
Yeah, I think the points you make are all valid. What I would say as well, with the analytics side of things, you know, a big part of it is actually trying to really get better value, or actually, if I could say this better, it's actually trying to make the decisions or give less room for judgment in those decisions. So you're not going to still get everything right using data analytics, but at least you're giving a rationale and some sort of explanation for why those decisions are being made. And too often not in football, as we know, Kieran, when we look at financials, you know, the misallocation of funds that's happened for various reasons, because as we know also that there's people investing in football clubs not purely for economic reasons, and everyone's got a different rationale, but when you look at it from an investment firm's lens, having those principles that you'd probably apply into the non-football world certainly does try and close the gap to those other investors who are out there.
Yeah, it must be very challenging indeed. So you've got Toulouse, Malaga, indirectly Liverpool. Are you looking to expand the portfolio? You know, I've seen some other organisations say, the benefit in terms of you've got revenue synergies, you've got cost synergies, you've got de-risking the fear of relegation. Is Redbird FC in a state of flux, or is it still on a growth phase in terms of actively looking to recruit more clubs to join the portfolio?
I would say the latter, Kieran. I think it's worth noting just to the listeners that, you know, after our Toulouse investment, we have a minority stake in an IPL cricket team as well. Mm-hmm. So away from the football world, but some of the fundamentals of that IPL league, similar to some of the American franchises. But certainly the focus in 2022 is looking back towards our next club acquisition. You know, we have a number of different criteria we look at when we're assessing clubs. To run through a few of them, we look for sustainable non-football business operations, major cities or desirable tourist destinations with favourable demographics. So Toulouse, fourth largest city in France, for example. Owned infrastructure and related revenue streams. So again, that's of interest. And one thing that I want to mention is identifying local partners as well.
Right.
Because, based in the US, you need to engage with the stakeholders. And that's something I think we can show that's happened or demonstrates happened well in Toulouse thus far. And something we think is a real key part of any investment we'd make in a future club.
Right. And, Football is a circus, and the circus rolls from town to town all the time. It must be very difficult trying to work out what is going to happen next. Where do you see football going? Certainly in terms of especially European football, perhaps football in the Middle East as well, given your experiences. We've got the Swiss model coming from UEFA. We've got still Super League won't die. As far as the comments from Perez and Agnelli and so on, and I think I work in the city of Liverpool. I think my views are fairly well known as a fan, but I'm also conscious of the fact that, in my view, Super League was a fantastic investment opportunity. But from a football point of view, I didn't like it. Where do you see things going over the next few years?
That's a great question. I think one thing is certain is I think there will be change. I see a lot of different clubs come across my desk on a weekly basis, and there's a consistent theme that there is liquidity issues there. Clubs are struggling. That cannot continue forever. So those who are offering to try and assist with capital. They are going to probably want to see in how things are run going forward, or at least have comfort that they might not get into that stage in the future. You've mentioned the Champions League's obviously evolving their ideas. The interesting thing for me is maybe just how the world looks at it as well. You have Middle East, you have the US, Will there be a shifting of where talent goes? No question mark. You know, I look at regulations as well, Kieran, and that's good. You know, financial fair play, you can see had an impact. COVID, I would argue, it probably got found out slightly. It's a pandemic. But actually, one of the best, in my opinion, one of the best things that could happen is just for good management to go into clubs, because you can have all the regulations in the world, but if you set policies at management level, and whether that's fan-based owned clubs or up to clubs owned by one person, that I just think there's a long way to go on that. And I'm particularly talking about European football and how things have been run over the piece. And that's something I would like to see happen, regardless of where things go in competition formats or jurisdictions. Actually, just good management going into clubs, and because ultimately it's fans that suffer if things things aren't managed well. And maybe that's something that might develop now we try and come out of a sort of post-pandemic world.
I agree with you entirely. You know, I see many clubs, as we all do. And one of the things that strikes me is that too often they are run as personal fiefdoms, as vanity projects. And the trouble is, if a club's a vanity project, if it's an executive toy, well, people get bored of toys, and that's fine if it's a toy. If it's a football club, which means so much to thousands and thousands of people, it impacts upon their life. And we all secretly know that football's a bit dumb. Because why should I wake up on a Monday morning thinking about a football match which is taking place in 6 days' time when I've got the full week ahead of me? But as a fan, and you know, you as a Celtic fan, you go through this amazing routine every week, and I go, I'm supposed to be a grown up, but I'm not. and that's why we love the game. It retains that innocence, that magic, and so on. I mean, Daniel. This has been absolutely educational for me, and I'd just like to say a huge thanks for coming on the show. Is there anything else you want to add that you'd like to sort of bring up which you think might be of interest to the listeners?
Well, just maybe to touch on that final point, just on what it means to fans, and I think closing it off back to the investment world, I think that's one and the same thing. The attraction of individuals to football is the opportunity there by that fan, that content, that live event that football brings, and that's really something I just thought would close nicely to what you said there. But for me, it's been a pleasure being on the podcast, Kieran. I've listened to it for a long time now. And I thank you for the opportunity to chat with you today.
Well, thank you. And if Redbird FC are looking for value in a football finance podcast, and as long as it doesn't involve the Swiss Ramble, we might have another conversation soon.
I look forward to that one, Kieran. I absolutely do.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Daniel's a proper high-level football finance chap. Well, I have to say, it sounds like running Celtic, Kieran, is all sorts of fun.
Yes. We say that New York is the city that never sleeps. Well, running one of the big firm in Glasgow is the job where you never sleep. I think Daniel said that 5 years is a good innings, because there's an awful lot of pressure, there's an awful lot of scrutiny. Everybody wants a piece of you, and everybody seems to think that they know more than you when it comes to giving advice.
I remember talking to Gordon Strachan about this at the Edinburgh Festival, talking about the great honour of managing the Celtic football team, but also the impossibility of ever going out in Glasgow while you're managing the club, for good reasons and bad reasons. Now, don't forget, everybody, the first ever Price of Football live show is happening at Plough Lane, the home of AFC Wimbledon, on Thursday the 24th of March. It's very difficult for you to forget because producer guy keeps asking us to remind you, even though you've already bought tickets. The original batch of 200 tickets sold out, so we added another 50. There are only a couple of those left. If you fancy it now, if we've twisted your arm, just go to the link in the description of this episode, and we will look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks' time. I spoke to several nice fans of the pod in the Porter's Arms before the game yesterday. They've got their tickets ready. One of them's got four questions that he wants to ask. he tried one out of me, and he was put off by my glazy stare. If you'd like to make a contribution to our always free to air pod, then that would be very kind of you. Please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question as well for our weekly questions pod, which broadcasts on a Monday, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks again, folks, for the feedback, for keeping us on our toes, and also for the kind words that you send us on so many occasions. It is appreciated. If you want to support us on Patreon, then that would be fantastic. If you just want to give us some good karma, go to your podcast apps and just give us a little review. If you can give us 5 stars, it helps us in the charts. Apple and Spotify and so on use algorithms, and you don't have to say anything nice about us. You could just say that you'd rather the show was presented by the two young Russian friends of my son who died 2 days ago.
I would at this stage, Kieran, under normal circumstances, sing you happy birthday, but in the circumstances, I won't do that. Plus, of course, it would cost producer guy about £25,000. I did a pilot for a TV show a few years back with a young, inexperienced producer. And we told him you couldn't sing happy birthday in a TV show. But he went ahead anyway. Yes. The show wasn't made, which is a shame because they could have made back the money they had to pay the people who owned the rights to happy birthday, the song. So I shall just content myself with saying happy birthday, old friend.
Thank you. The Price of Football. The Price of Football.